Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, new federal dietary guidelines are sparking debate over what Americans should eat, from red meat and fats to sugar and processed foods. We'll talk with Ulster County Public Health Director Dr. Eve Walter about what the changes can mean for health outcomes. With the State of the State tomorrow, energy advocates are pushing Governor Kathy Hochul to focus on affordability. What do they want to hear? We'll ask. This winter, Hudson Valley's LGBTQ+ and allied a cappella chorus Key of Q is marking a decade of music with a new concert called It's About Time. We'll talk with them about community, harmony, and what 10 years together really sounds like. Plus, local economic perspective from James B. Huntington. And a report from a local protest from our own Kimberly Izar, coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks opened lower this morning after news that the Justice Department has opened a criminal probe of the Federal Reserve. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 180 points in early trading.
The Federal Reserve says it received grand jury subpoenas late last week about the costly renovation of the central bank's headquarters building in Washington and Fed Chairman Jerome Powell's testimony about that project before a Senate committee. In an unusually combative video statement, however, Powell says those are mere pretext. He says the threat of criminal charges is part of the administration's broader pressure campaign, designed to force the Fed to move more quickly in lowering interest rates. The Fed was set up to be insulated from that kind of political meddling, but President Trump has ignored those guardrails. The president is getting pushback, however, from some senators who will vote on Trump's nominee to replace Powell when the chairman's term ends in May. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump says Iran called the U.S. over the weekend to negotiate. He told reporters yesterday Tehran sought to set up a meeting after he threatened military strikes against Iran. Trump has suggested even if he has the meeting, he may still take military action against Iran first. The Trump administration says it will surge more federal agents to Minnesota this week to deal with immigration issues. There are more than 2,000 federal agents already there. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey says the Trump administration is not trying to promote safety. It is seeking political retribution.
What's happening is full-on discrimination. It's targeting Somali people in our city, targeting Latino people in Minneapolis, and looking for a problem that, to be clear, we are not seeing on our streets.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. The surge comes after an ICE agent shot and killed a Minneapolis woman last week. In Alaska, Democrat Mary Peltola, the first Alaska Native person elected to Congress, says she is running for the U.S. Senate. Peltola is challenging Republican incumbent Senator Dan Sullivan. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
With Peltola, national Democrats believe Alaska becomes one of their best hopes to flip a seat. In a campaign launch video, Peltola stressed her salmon-centered family life on Alaska's Kuskokwim River and repeated her previous campaign slogan, Fish, Family, Freedom.
Systemic change is the only way to bring down grocery costs, save our fisheries, lower energy prices, and build new housing Alaskans can afford.
Sullivan is campaigning with President Trump's endorsement. Alaska's other senator, moderate Republican Lisa Murkowski, is a frequent Trump critic. She's endorsed Peltola in the past, but says she's endorsing Sullivan now to keep the Senate's Republican majority. For NPR News, I'm Liz Ruskin.
You're listening to NPR. Authorities in Jackson, Mississippi, say they've arrested a suspect in connection with a fire at a local synagogue. The person has been charged with arson. No one was hurt. The blaze began Saturday in the synagogue's library, and two Torahs were destroyed. The governments of Malaysia and Indonesia have blocked access to the AI chatbot Grok. It's owned by billionaire Elon Musk. Both countries say they're alarmed over its deep fake videos that allow users to post sexual content of children and women without their consent. Today, Britain's media watchdog office launched an investigation of Grok over the same issue. Florida now allows anyone who is pregnant to get a disabled parking permit for 1 year. Disability rights advocates are suing. From member station WUSF, Carrie Sheridan has more.
Almost 10,000 women in Florida have received temporary disabled parking permits, including Destiny Light.
You're carrying around a whole baby. Like, it hurts. Your back hurts. Your legs hurt. Like, everything just hurts.
The plaintiff in the case is Olivia Keller, a 49-year-old woman who uses a motorized wheelchair and says parking is already hard to find.
People with disabilities are kind of an afterthought. The accommodations that we receive and are required to receive by law aren't really looked at as needs. It's looked at as a perk.
She is suing to overturn the law. The state has filed a motion to dismiss. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Sheridan in Tampa.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down about 190 points. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. As Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro and his wife Celia Flores await their next court appearance, organizers in the Mid-Hudson Valley are pushing back against U.S. involvement in Venezuela. A coalition of local activist groups gathered in Newburgh yesterday afternoon, calling for an end to the U.S. military intervention. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar reports.
Viva, viva Venezuela!
Viva, viva Venezuela!
Lucha, lucha Venezuela!
Lucha, lucha Venezuela!
It's a chilly Sunday afternoon in Newburgh, New York, where dozens of Hudson Valley activists gather on the corner of Broadway and Liberty Street in front of the John Lewis statue. They chant a clear message they want to send to the U.S. government. Javier Fernando Carrillo is an organizer with the Hudson Valley Party for Socialism and Liberation chapter. He says that the protest is about pushing back against U.S. intervention in Venezuela, just days after the U.S. seized Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro and his wife Celia Flores in Venezuela.
Today, we are setting the groundwork for building the anti-war movement in the Hudson Valley. We are here to show solidarity with the Venezuelan people in this egregious war crime that was bombing a sovereign nation, killing over 100 people, and literally abducting a sitting sovereign president.
Protesters hold bright yellow signs that read, "No blood for oil," and "U.S. out of the Caribbean." On Wednesday, the Trump administration said that the U.S. plans to control Venezuela's oil sales indefinitely. Newburgh City Council member Giselle Martinez says that the U.S. actions to destabilize foreign nations have a local impact.
And I am not here to speak for Venezuela, but I am here to speak as a U.S. taxpayer who is tired of our tax dollars going to unnecessary wars.
And that the U.S.'s escalating attacks hurt working class people the most.
We see people who are struggling to fend for themselves, and we are here in solidarity to say that we are against the illegal acts of war. People are suffering. People will die. We have our own issues in our own backyard, too, where people can't afford rent, cannot afford groceries. And if we don't put in the resources to our community, we definitely should not be spending resources in war to bomb other people.
The protest was organized by a coalition of local activist groups, including the PSL Hudson Valley, Mid-Hudson Valley Democratic Socialists of America, Rally Middletown, and Veterans for Peace. Rally Middletown co-founder Amanda Crump says she's here to organize with her neighbors to put pressure on the U.S. government not to start a war.
We've seen this pattern time and time again. There's always some sort of similar excuse as to why we are, disrupting in other countries. But at the end of the day, there's innocent people that are being killed in Venezuela, the same way there's innocent people being killed in Palestine, innocent people in Iraq. There's countless examples where the American government is, meddling in things that are none of their business, and innocent people are getting hurt.
In Newburgh, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
The people united will never be defeated.
Thanks to Kim for that report. Now, the federal government recently unveiled updated national dietary guidelines that stress whole, minimally processed foods and an inverted food pyramid that places proteins, healthy fats, and vegetables at the top. These new guidelines are shaking up longstanding advice about what Americans should eat. To help us understand what this could mean for your health, we're joined now by Dr. Eve Walter, Public Health Director for Ulster County. Dr. Walter, welcome.
Thank you.
The new guidance emphasizes higher consumption of protein, including red meat and full-fat dairy, reduction of processed foods and added sugar. What aspects of these recommendations align with or diverge from what health data tell you about dietary guidelines, diet-related health issues, and how are you thinking about these changes from a public health perspective?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I want to first separate that there's a bit of a difference between the recommendations as they're written in the words and the recommendations as the visual appears. Because as we know, so the recommendations when you write, when it was written, the new recommendations of reduced saturated fats completely align with, you know, general understandings of how we should eat. And even just improving the amount of protein that people have is not anything new. When you then look at the image, though, it's a recommending, the protein recommendations are typically like a giant pitcher of a steak or whole milk. These are tend to be higher in saturated fats, so it starts confusing the message a little bit. While the written recommendations support whole grains, it's showing up so small at the base of the inverted pyramid that it sort of suggests that these should be used sparingly. When the pyramid was turned the other way, the fats and oils that were sitting at the top of the pyramid that was in the small, the whole idea was that it should be sparing. So I feel like if you take the language in the written recommendations, they are not that divergent from what we would hope people do. There are some extremes, like the increased expectations of protein feel a bit unrealistic for people to be able to consume in a typical diet. But mostly, you know, and then some things like, you know, expecting children not having any sugar under the age of 10 is just not a realistic expectation to have on people. So yeah. Some of them are really valid and some of them are a little confusing.
I've seen some headlines out about the visual, you know, one of them saying that the new food pyramid is lying to you and that it's also confusing nutrition experts. But as you say, in the written recommendations, some of those things are welcome. Some nutrition experts have raised concerns, though, that emphasizing red meat and saturated fats could conflict with decades of research, especially on cardiovascular risk. How do you interpret and communicate that to the public?
Yeah, well, and again, I mean, the language in it says reduced saturated fats. It just doesn't show up in the visual like it's a reduction of saturated fats. Yep. The visual looks like it's quite a bit of saturated fats. You know, I think that the research is a bit mixed on exactly how much saturated fats are, you know, should a person avoid. It's obviously been associated with higher risks of different kind of cardiovascular diseases. But, you know, I mean, I think a really important thing, especially as a public health expert, is like taking a step back for a second and thinking like, what does this turn into? I mean, in reality, I don't know, like the last time, let's go back a month ago, when you cooked food for your family or went to a restaurant, you weren't pulling up your pyramid to figure out how you should order your food. And so I'm actually less, I'm not really expecting that your average person on a day-to-day basis will sit here, you know, and all of a sudden be dramatically changing their diet as a result of this. I think that, you know, the problem that I have is a much more broader kind of public health focus, like this idea that it has lack of cultural sensitivity. There are many cultures who consume large amounts you know, of rice and grains, and healthily consume them. And it's sort of suggestive that how they're eating is not appropriate. It doesn't at all address access to food. It doesn't address the fact that fast food, highly processed fast food. It's way less expensive than healthy fruits and vegetables, that we have these food deserts in places. And so I guess I'm less concerned about the scientific accuracy and inaccuracy, although there are plenty of things that are in this that don't have any real scientific support and some that do. I'm more worried about the fact that it feels like some of this might have a political motivation. You know, are they being strongly supported by the beef industry and milk industry? But also, is it just moving the conversation about what it would really take to make people healthier?
Dietary guidelines influence federal nutrition programs like school lunches and SNAP and other local food initiatives. What changes do you anticipate at the local level as these new guidelines are incorporated into these programs?
Yeah, they're already happening. I'm not anticipating. So we have a WIC program, and the WIC program recipients receive a card so that they can go shopping, and the food is covered. So already recipients are being, this is dictating sort of what will be covered more, what will be covered less. So we do have to have our nutritionists educate individuals. The challenge is, you know, like there's definitely a higher level of proteins and fruits and vegetables being covered. There's still this issue of access to, you know, fruits and vegetables that are healthy, that are in good condition, that are located in these communities. Sometimes individuals are shopping in places where fruits and vegetables are not commonly available, easily available or affordable. But, you know, we are seeing it already in what will be covered for our WIC recipients.
And given those folks who receive WIC, are you hearing from folks at all, or how do you see challenges or even opportunities in helping residents adopt these recommendations?
I mean, it's new. It's unfolding as we speak, and luckily for a WIC recipient, they have a qualified nutritionist that they can reach out to all the time and talk to understand. And we're trying our best. Already, we have been setting an agenda for our Department of Health to really figure out how we can educate people on how to identify and cook and, you know, the healthiest foods possible. I think that not everyone has that opportunity. If you're on SNAP, the food guidelines that impact these food pantry fundings, those don't always have a qualified nutritionist available to kind of talk it through with the individual. So I think we're fortunate because we do, WIC programs are fortunate in that way. Other people are kind of going to have to navigate it on their own, and that's a concern. And again, as I said before, there are issues with consumption that we have in our country that are highly associated to poor health conditions. Many of those issues are just not even addressed in these new guidelines. And so, you know, that's the bigger concern. They're still going to come to us and say, well, we're not sure where we can find this food, or, you know, again, the fast food chains that are all over the place are still offering what looks like a fully complex, large meal for less money than, you know, the healthier foods.
Right.
And nothing's being done to really address that.
The new guidelines also remove specific daily limits on alcohol, which were previously set at no more than one drink per day for women and two for men. Instead, it advises Americans to drink, quote, less alcohol for better overall health. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There was a lot of vague things also to avoid, you know, chemical additives, but it doesn't actually describe or state which chemical additives. These guidelines are much shorter than what we've seen in the past. Again, I will say, I don't know how much once this is out of the news cycle, how much people are going to even remember and regard these kinds of things. Already, it just feeds into the larger confusion. I mean, you could probably think back of the last 10 years and hearing that a glass of wine is bad, a glass of wine is good, it's actually better to have the glass of wine than not. You know, this is all just becomes confusing to the public who don't know, you know, where things are and or why things would change and what's the motivation behind it. And so I think it just contributes to people feeling like they're kind of out there on their own just trying to figure it out and being given multiple messages, stop for the fast food or do the other kinds of things. It also doesn't address, you know, what contributes to alcohol consumption and alcoholism. Like I said, it impacts, you know, there's nothing about that. There's nothing about food additives. There's nothing about cultural differences in how individuals eat. It doesn't address those people who are lactose intolerant and do not want to consume dairy or can't consume dairy. You know, it's lacking almost more than it's providing.
What key health outcomes will you be watching to gauge whether these guideline changes are improving or harming public health locally as it cycles out of the news?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for us, it will continue to be on food access and healthy food access. I mean, that's the most important thing for us. Whichever way you want to turn this pyramid, you know, we have a very clear sense that what kinds of food are healthy for individuals to eat in general without having to bring it down to. I mean, I don't think anyone really knows how to count how many servings exactly they've had of anything. So, you know, really getting the message of not only what healthy foods are out there, but really how is access working? How do we help people improve their access to these foods? How do we help people understand how to cook these foods that they may, you know, potentially be less familiar with? So, you know, for us, the more the one-on-one or one-on-ten kind of messaging where we can do education and really have the opportunity to reach individuals on their level, depending, again, on their cultural or dietary specifics, that we can really help them provide the healthiest foods for themselves and others, and really contribute to the conversation that, you know, we have these food deserts. We have people who have to sometimes travel very far just to get to a supermarket, especially in these more rural communities. And that's a real problem. If they, you know, I'm a big fan of Stewart's in general, but it's, you know, it's a concern if that's the only source of place that you have to shop for the food for your family.
That's Dr. Eve Walter, Public Health Director for Ulster County. We've been talking about the new federal dietary guidelines and their impact locally. Dr. Walter, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, rising energy costs are already forcing tough choices for New York families. We'll hear what advocates say needs to change ahead of Governor Kathy Hochul's State of the State address. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Laura Flanders. Join me Monday evenings at 7 on Radio Catskill for Laura Flanders and Friends. It's the show where the people who say it can't be done take a back seat to the people who are doing it. Then stay with us for three more Powerhouse Talk programs back to back. Sabrina Artel's Trailer Talk at 7:30, The Janice Adams Show at 8, and La Voz en Breve with Mariel Fiore at 9. Monday evenings, starting at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, the Three Sons team up with a pipe organ for the musical equivalent of Godzilla stomping on Bambi. And there's something new by Mondo Hamondo. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As New York faces rising energy costs, advocates are urging Governor Kathy Hochul to make affordability a central focus of her State of the State address tomorrow. Gas prices are projected to more than double by 2026 compared to 2024, and already one in seven New Yorkers is behind on their energy bills. Joining us now is Kim Fraycheck, Director of Sane Energy, to talk about what's at stake for New Yorkers and what advocates want to hear from the governor. Kim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You and other advocates are coming off some major wins, including repealing the 100-foot rule and securing funding for Empower Plus. Why do these wins matter for New Yorkers right now?
Yeah, sure. I mean, New Yorkers, we're in the midst of a major energy affordability crisis, and utility companies keep jacking up the price of heat, electricity, and keep making massive profits. Even though we've had some recent wins that rein in utility corporations, you know, control of our energy system to provide us with resources to help us navigate those energy costs. We were able to repeal the 100-foot rule, which allows utilities to charge all of us customers to extend gas pipes into new buildings. And that won't take effect until January of 2027. Other heating and cooking options exist that don't require these expenses, we're all still paying for it. So in the past, you know, the 100-foot rule has cost New Yorkers an additional $600 million in quote-unquote delivery charges. If you look at your gas bill, you'll see that. And apart from saving New Yorkers money, the law will keep utilities from making profits off extending expensive gas pipelines when there's cheaper and far better options out there. And, you know, the Empower Plus victory was huge. It's the state's flagship energy efficiency program, and that will help to allocate funding to low and moderate income New Yorkers to pay for energy efficiency upgrades in their home. And this is everything from weatherization to more efficient appliances. And it was going to be facing a budget cut starting in 2026, but the new funding will help more New Yorkers be able to upgrade their homes to consume less energy and lower our bills. So these are both policies, Empower Plus and repealing the 100-foot rule, that are helping the affordability crisis that we're facing.
And as Governor Hochul heads into her State of the State address tomorrow, you know, you've mentioned the state of energy affordability in New York. What do you want to hear from the governor?
Well, you know, I want her to at least acknowledge that she knows that more and more people are falling behind on their energy bills. Not just in New York, but this is across the country, and we have an opportunity to lead here in New York. You know, 13% of New Yorkers are 60 or more days behind on paying their energy bills. And the cost of energy is rising. At the same time, federal and state programs that help people reduce energy usage and help with bill payment, they're ending and they're facing budget cuts. So, you know, as she heads into her State of the State tomorrow, a lot of people are looking at her to help address these serious challenges we're facing for working families across the whole state.
What are you hearing from those households across the state that are behind on their energy bills?
People that I know, and I'm based in Brooklyn, New York, people are like, playing financial Tetris with their bills. They're like, we have to go grocery shopping. We need to figure out how we can cut our budget on groceries so we can pay for our national grid bill, which is skyrocketing. It's a real issue when, you know, families can't figure out how to manage their bills because corporations continue to, you know, expand gas infrastructure and make our bills rise. We know that the gas is the reason behind all of this, you know. So we're really looking to Governor Hochul not just to say things tomorrow, but to actually put programs into action, as we're looking to her for that leadership.
The supporters of the new gas infrastructure in the state, like reviving gas plants and moving forward with the NESE pipeline, they argue that it's needed for reliability. How do you respond? Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it isn't. I mean, we have, several experts, you know, that were working with us in National Grid's rate cases and National Grid's long-term gas plan. And it's proven there is absolutely no need for extra gas and maybe into 2042. So we know that gas is a volatile energy source, and it's, you know, now it's getting even more, you know, fiery, dependent on global and national politics. We know that, you know, gas is being driven by the Trump administration's quote unquote energy dominance policies that have, you know, increased, you know, exporting LNG. You know, this is straining, you know, domestic gas supply, driving up costs, you know, and we know that the New York gas companies are raising rates over and over again just to keep the ball rolling for them. You know, they know that this is a model that works for them. And, if Governor Hochul wants to actually be a leader here, she needs to put an end to this, you know, Ponzi scheme that the gas utilities have going. It's absolutely ridiculous that we would be continuing to feed into and build and construct a 19th century energy system that poisons us and increases our bills.
There are some estimates that the NESE pipeline could add more than $7 a month to build, while South Fork Wind, the large wind farm off of the outer continental shelf of Rhode Island, in the Long Island Sound, it would only add about $1.58, or only cost about $1.58 per household. So what does that tell you about where the state should invest?
Well, you know, the state, you know, cut, you know, pretended that it was an affordability issue with the offshore wind connections. And, you know, I feel that Governor Hochul is absolutely doing the bidding of Donald Trump. I mean, honestly, you know, she did not stand up to him when he wanted to push through the NESE pipeline that, as you mentioned, is going to be a major increase on our energy bills. And it's, you know, it's $7.50 for the next 15 years, because it's about $3.2 billion for 15 years for all of us to pay for that, a pipeline that we don't need. And then on top of that, you know, there's all the extra infrastructure that goes into supporting that pipeline coming in. So $7.50 additional a month is just the start. I mean, they're coming back. National Grid is coming back for another request for a rate hike in, you know, probably this spring. And we are ready to fight. This is just not something that is going to be in service. And if Governor Hochul wants to show that she cares about affordability, she'll stand with us in the fight against National Grid rate hikes.
Looking ahead to that State of the State tomorrow, what's the single most important commitment you want to hear from Governor Hochul to lower energy bills?
Well, you know, we want to make sure that, you know, she will decommission gas in this state. That is the reason why we are seeing increases on our energy bills. We need a commitment for gas decommissioning. We need a commitment to even expanding Empower Plus, making sure that weatherization and energy efficiency are top priority to help people save money. We know that we need the Green Affordable Pre-Electrification Program. It's called the GAP Fund. We need to really increase that to make sure that people that, you know, can't afford energy efficiency upgrades because they have pre-existing conditions like roof issues or, foundation issues on their home or building, we want to be able to make sure that those folks can get their buildings upgraded to be decarbonized, clean, efficient, and moving our building stock into the 21st century. We know we have a lot of energy affordability programs, New York Sun. We really want to see her bolster, you know, the renewable energy and energy efficiency programs. She did not do any service to the energy affordability last year. We have a dismal year with Governor Hochul in 2025. And if she wants to remain governor in 2026 and win this election this year, she better really prioritize decommissioning gas and funding renewable energy and energy efficiency.
That's Kim Fraycheck, director of Sane Energy, talking about what's at stake for New Yorkers ahead of the State of the State tomorrow from Governor Kathy Hochul. What's at stake for New Yorkers when it comes to energy? You can learn more at saneenergy.org. Kim, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And a reminder, you can hear Governor Kathy Hochul's State of the State address live here tomorrow on Radio Catskill at 1, or you can stream it on our website, WJFFradio.org. We'll take a break, and when we come back, local economic perspective from James B. Huntington. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. From inpatient and outpatient care to primary, urgent, and specialty care with Garnet Health doctors in Sullivan County. Exceptional lives here. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
Legal scholars say President Trump broke international law when he attacked Venezuela.
The cornerstone of the UN Charter is Article 2.4, prohibiting exactly the kind of use of force that we saw. The claim that this was self-defense is just implausible on its face.
But does it even matter when breaking those same laws have little to no consequence? That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, it's Monday and time for local economic perspective from James B. Huntington.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
All right, let's talk about Friday's jobs report. What happened there?
Yes, well, we have a bunch of things happening. It was generally favorable. We had employment went up only 50,000. That's close to the 65,000 average of estimates I saw. It's not great, but it's not awful either. Seasonally adjusted and adjusted unemployment each went down 0.2%, 4.4%, and 4.1% now. The adjusted jobless number fell 300,000. Still 1.9 million long-term unemployed. There are 200,000 fewer people who are working part-time for economic reasons or keeping those jobs while looking thus far unsuccessfully for full-time ones. It dropped, but it's still way high at 5.3 million. Labor force participation rate and employment population ratio were split. The first one was down 0.1% to 62.4, but the second one went up 59.7%, 1% also. Non-farm payroll earnings gained 16 cents, slightly more than inflation, to 37.02, rather. The AJSN told us that there were 300,000 fewer jobs in latent demand beyond ones that are advertised this past month. That's now at 16.7 million. Overall, I was quite happy with it. I was glad that unemployment went down significantly at that when it had been going up every month before. So there are a lot of people who reported they were out of the labor force, saying they didn't want jobs. Those went up 900 and some thousand and 700 and some thousand, but they may follow through now that the holidays are over. If there's not, this is clearly good. So this is thumbs up for December.
Even though there's a bit of a weakening labor market, you think that's showing some positive signs?
Oh, the labor market is not great, but the jobs report in general moved in the right direction.
Okay. What happened with the trade deficit? The latest data we have there is from October.
Okay, we're seeing things there, some effect from tariffs. So in October, the imports were down 3.2% to $331 billion. Exports rose 2.6% to $302 billion. So that gets us a $29.4 billion trade deficit, which is down 39%. That's a big improvement, but we can decide whether all these tariffs are worth it. I do not think so, but they did have a positive effect here. So we're trying to shrink the trade gap in some ways. That certainly did happen this month. So we'll keep an eye on that and see how it goes in the months to come.
All right. Let's talk about something we ran out of time last week to talk about. What are the top paying jobs for the Myers-Briggs personality types. That's a way of measuring personalities.
Okay, everyone should know their Myers-Briggs rating. So since I have 16 of these jobs to run out, I'm going to run by them soon. So unfortunately, if you don't know your Myers-Briggs, you may be SOL this segment here. So ISTJ, the best paying jobs with some kind of numbers behind them. ISTJ, surgeon. INFJ, psychiatrist. ESTJ, airline captain. INTP, physicist. ENFP, advertising director. ENTJ, that's me, prosecutor. ENFJ, human resources manager. ESTP, sales manager. ISFJ, pharmacist. ISTP, electrical engineer. INTJ, data scientist. INFP, animator. ENTP, forensic psychologist. ESFP, model. ESFJ, post-secondary teacher. And ISFP, fashion designer. So think about these. Think about the one that applies to you. If you're looking at a career change or it's earlier in the game and you're looking to establish a career, you should seriously consider these.
And if you don't know your personality type, you can find out at MyersBriggs.org. They've got them all listed there, and you can figure it out. Let's figure out something that you should talk to your adult children about, and it's not about sex. What's that?
Yes, this was a rather good headline from this USA Today article from last month, and it said, it's time to have the talk with your adult kids. And then it said, it's not about sex. So what is it about? It is about taking the time and effort to tell your adult children about your finances, your estate plan, and end-of-life wishes. Now, this is hard to do. I can tell you that. My parents sort of tried this and fell more or less on their faces. It's difficult because a lot of times parents don't want to tell children really the truth about how they're doing financially. They won't have much of a context to put it in anyway. So it's important. It is critically important that they know that they get straight answers to these issues. Like, what is your money situation? What do you have as far as savings and insurance and debt? Also, tell them what you want to do. If you have a power of attorney, if you want to establish them to make their decisions, to make your decisions for them when you can't make them, it's time to get established with that. So fill them in about all this. And they say the time really that you should do it is as soon as they're ready. And if they're adults, they're ready. Even teenagers, you might tell something, some general idea about what you think. Like, a lot of people don't even know if their parents want to be cremated. Yeah. And that's the kind of thing that really makes a mess when you're sitting there living with people who can execute those things. The end of the thing said, as you lay out your assets and accounts, explain why you have them. Tell your children why you hung on to that investment property and whether your retirement savings is more or less than you'd hoped. Again, this is a rough one, but it's critically important because once the children get to be adults, you need them on your side to do what you want to do and to get through the always hard thing if something should happen to them.
Good to be informed and prepared. Let's talk about the numbers. How were the latest stock, oil, and other numbers this morning, and how did they change?
Yes, this is 1 week from early this morning. Gold, $45.95, up $163. That was a huge week to reach another all-time high. Silver, $84.28, even huger, plus $8.19, a huger week. It's crazy. The ratio is now 54 to 1, 54.5 to 1 with gold. So silver just keeps going and going. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, 49,124, up 726. That's a all-time high here, too, as it was for NASDAQ, 23,671, up 435, a higher percentage than the Dow did. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 58.77, up $1.47, but it's still staying quite low, and pump prices, at least what I'm seeing in New York and New Jersey, are still dropping. Bitcoin, 90,698, that is down an even $2,000. Looks like that's going to be its range for a while. It's not too far from 90,000 these days, for better or worse. I mean, this could go crazy up or down any day without us knowing, but it seems to be hanging out in a small area for now. British pound, 1.3462, plus 1/5 of a cent, slowly increasing, continuing to do that, as is the euro, 1.1692, or up 0.12 of a cent. Just doing the same thing. The Japanese 100 yen coin, 63 cents, dropped a penny. That was one of the world's best currencies for a long time, but now it's just no traction, no life. So overall, it's hard to believe these metals, and platinum and palladium I don't report on, but those have also gone up quite a bit in the 2000s for platinum and in the 1000s for palladium, if I remember right. And an ordinary silver quarter from, say, the 1950s has over $15 in silver in it now.
Wow, amazing.
Otherwise, it's just stronger, stronger, stronger. I mean, when will it stop? When will these things going, especially with silver, reverse? Well, unfortunately, I don't know either.
All right. Well, you'll keep us informed. It's James B. Huntington, our local economist and author with Local Economic Perspective. We'll take a break next week for the holiday, but we'll see you in a couple weeks. James B., thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, for 10 years, Key of Q has been bringing voices together across the Hudson Valley, celebrating love, identity, and community through a cappella music. We'll learn more next. This is Radio Chatskill.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple, free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Hudson Valley's LGBTQ plus and allied a cappella chorus, Key of Q, is marking a major milestone this winter, 10 years of making music and building community. The group's new concert, It's About Time, celebrates that journey with performances across the region this weekend. Joining us now is Terry Gibson, Managing Director of Key of Q. Terry, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
For listeners who may be hearing about Key of Q for the first time, how do you describe the chorus, both musically and as a community?
Well, we are based in Kingston, New York. We are an auditioned group of LGBTQ plus and allied singers. We travel from all corners of the Hudson Valley to blend our voices and perform beautiful a cappella music together. Musically, we focus mostly on modern secular music in complex, multi-part harmonies with themes including equality, love, celebration of identity in its many forms. And over our 10 years together, we've become really a chosen family with deep and abiding connections. We practice love and support and acceptance and really celebrate all of our unique voices.
What were some of the earliest goals for the group when it was formed about a decade ago, and how have those goals evolved over time?
Well, the earliest goals of providing a welcoming and supportive space for queer and allied singers and striving for excellent musicianship, they're goals that we will always continue to actively pursue. They haven't changed, and I don't think they ever will, but as we've become more established and accomplished, we've been able to look toward expanding that out into the community. For instance, we're now looking for members of the community who share our values and vision and perhaps have expertise in areas like grant writing and fundraising to join our board so that we can move beyond worrying about funding day-to-day operations and use our voices to support and raise funds for other queer-positive organizations in the Hudson Valley. We're very, very proud of the new One Day Chorus series that we started just this past October. If you have a minute, I'll explain what that is.
Yeah, tell us about it.
Okay, well, we know a lot of folks love to sing, but just can't make the time commitment needed to sing in a chorus and rehearse every week. So for our one-day chorus, we ask for a commitment of just one afternoon. And for this one afternoon, you can join the members of Key of Q as we all learn one song together in full four-part a cappella harmony, and then sing it out loud and proud and in community. There's no audition, there's no pressure, just fun harmonies, great vibes, and a room full of people who love to sing. The whole process is paired with cocktails or mocktails. We do this at Unicorn Bar, which is a great community-oriented queer space in Kingston. And all proceeds go to benefit a local queer-positive organization. When we did it in October, we were able to raise hundreds of dollars for the Hudson Valley LGBTQ plus Community Center. So we're very excited about that. We're very excited to be in a position where we can now look toward helping other organizations.
You mentioned your repertoire centers on contemporary secular music and themes like equality, love, and identity. How do you decide which songs best reflect that mission?
Well, it's one of the great things, and one of the things I love most about Key of Q is our music selection process. It's very different than most choruses. Most choruses, the artistic director just says, here's what we're singing, you know, they put forth the repertoire, and that's it. But for Key of Q, we're highly collaborative and democratic. We encourage all members to suggest songs, and then about once a month, our music team, which is actually about half the chorus now, we meet outside of rehearsal time, and we look at those suggestions. We discuss lyrics and themes and artists. We look for potential arrangements. And then, you know, we also look for queer connections. We strive to have about half of our music celebrate something about the queer community, whether that's an artist or through the themes. Then once we've had these discussions, music team votes on the songs we'd like to see included, and the artistic director bases the final song selections on the results of that vote. And we feel that because each member has such a direct hand in shaping the repertoire and what we sing, that the music becomes much more personal and meaningful. And it fosters not only more of an emotional connection to the music, but a stronger sense of community and cohesion within the group itself.
Your It's About Time concert for winter is this weekend, Friday in Beacon, Saturday in Kingston, Sunday in New Paltz. Tell us a little bit about the theme behind It's About Time. What are you hoping audiences will feel or reflect on in as they listen to it?
Okay. Well, It's About Time, it grew out of the very real feeling that almost all of us share right now, especially, that time feels really strange. You know, some days it just rushes past, and other days it feels heavy and slow. But ultimately, the passage of time in all of its complexity, it's a universally shared human experience. And the concert explores time in all of its forms. We look at time as memory, time as longing, time as pressure, time as healing. And ultimately, It's About Time is an invitation to pause, to listen, and to remember that even when the world feels dark and rushed and uncertain, that our lives and our communities can still unfold in meaningful, beautiful, joyful ways, and we're all here to support one another.
What's the rehearsal process look like as you prepare for a concert like this? And can you share a moment from rehearsals where something kind of clicked?
Well, the rehearsal process, it's actually pretty intense because, you know, for a cappella music, that is a lot harder and a lot more difficult than learning to sing something with a piano or an orchestra accompaniment where you have other instruments to rely on. So we have about 3.5 to 4 months to prepare for each concert cycle. At the first rehearsal, we'll introduce 3 or 4 new songs, and we do what we call a crash and burn run through of each of these new songs. And basically, we sight read them, right? Right out of the gate. And, you know, we push through as best we can. And again, with no piano, no rhythm section, it's just us. It's just our voices. Sometimes the results are terrific, and sometimes it just shows us how much work we have to do. But that's where we start. And then with each rehearsal, we spend a little more time working on each of the songs. We might introduce one more new song and crash and burn that. But then we get more and more details as the season progresses. We're adding dynamics, unifying breathing. You know, is this legato, which is smooth and sweet, or is it staccato and emphasized and powerful? And we create the emotional journey of the music through that. And as I said, it's a very demanding process. We expect a lot from each member, and we expect them to do a lot of homework. So we all come to rehearsal prepared to take each song to the next level. I don't know, your question, you asked about a specific moment. I don't know that there's one specific moment, but a moment that I love that happens every rehearsal is, and it consistently resonates with me, it's the feeling of connection that happens as we begin to focus and warm up. We all come into the room, we've had a crazy week and scattered lives, but then when we focus and we begin our vocal exercises and we begin our breathing exercises, you know, when you sing in a group, science has now backed this up, your heartbeat and your brain waves literally sync up. And it's a connection unlike any other, it's a connection unlike anything I've felt in another group. Yeah. And it's just such a wonderful feeling that when that begins to happen each and every week, you actually feel the room settle and you can feel that connection and that synchronicity happen.
Where can folks learn more about the It's About Time concert this weekend and also about the group?
Well, you can visit our website, and that is keyofq.org. There is a ticket link. There's a link for About Us. Join our mailing list. You can follow us on social media, which is, you know, Facebook and Instagram. We are at Key of Q. And, you know, we just would love everyone to know that, you know, you don't have to know anything about choral music. You don't have to be LGBTQ+ to belong with us. Just be open to being moved. Our singers put their whole selves into the music, and that creates a kind of honesty you can really feel in the sound.
That's Terry Gibson, Managing Director of Key of Q, the Hudson Valley's LGBTQ+ and Allied a cappella chorus. Terry, we're going to go out on a little bit of music from the Gala Festival of 2024. Thank you so much for joining us.
Terrific. Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Tim. It was great to be here.
Dance, dance the night away, ooh, whoa, whoa.
Dance, dance, baby, you can. Find me under the lights. Don't you want to just come along for the ride? Oh, ooh, my arms are so tight. See my heart beat you. I can shake you, baby, best me. That's the moment I shine. Ooh, every romance shakes in its head. Don't you look dead? When the night's here, out of your tears, baby, no chance. I could dance, I could dance, I could dance.
Watch me.
Key of Q from their Gala Festival in 2024. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality. On Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at TavernOnMainNY.com.
I'm Donna Fellenberg, host of Catskill Character. Join us Saturdays at 10:30 for stories from fascinating characters of the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania, right here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, partly sunny and windy with a high of 35. Cloudy tonight, low of 24. For tomorrow, breezy in the afternoon, high of 38. Looking for some rain moving into the area for Wednesday, high 39. And then back to colder temperatures by Friday. On Point is next.